Welcome to the Irish Photography Podcast. Take control of your camera and develop the skills necessary to improve and master your photography. Join me, Dermot O'Donovan, John Myler and Darren J. Spoonley as they cut through the sometimes confusing jargon of photography to help you find your own style and decide what's best for you. A mix of educational, inspirational, honest and sometimes controversial content delivered in a unique, fun way from three of Ireland's talented photographers. Let's go. Okay, guys, welcome along to the Irish Photography Podcast. Today's podcast is a very special one. Like we said, once a month, we will invite on a special guest. And today is our very, very first special guest, and we have Mr. Michael O'Sullivan. How are you, Michael?
I'm good. How are you?
Absolutely fantastic. And also with us today is Michael's fellow Corkman, Darren. How are you, Darren?
Wonderful, wonderful. Looking forward to talking to Michael today. Yeah. How are you, Dad?
Brilliant, brilliant. And then we have John from Shannon. How are you, John?
How you doing, lads? Darren, Dad, Michael, how are you doing? Looking forward to chatting as well.
Same here. How are things?
Good, good. Not a bother, thanks.
Now, one thing... Now,
if I crash the car while we're talking, it just means the questions were too difficult, okay?
Yeah.
Okay, so very good, Michael. So, lads, Michael O'Sullivan is a creative professional photographer, and he's based in Cork, Ireland. And Michael's photography has been a very inspirational one for me. His work is absolutely fantastic. It's just out of this world. A bit creepy to some people, and very moody to others. Me personally, I could never ever create something so special as Michael can, and it's great to have Michael on here today to maybe share some of his ideas and how he kind of does these things. Michael, could you just kind of lead us through what type of photographer you are, where you came from and what you do?
I'll try to give you the short version, which is normally about 4 hours, okay? I originally... I used to paint a lot. I used to draw and paint. As a kid, it's all I used to do. Like when all the other lads were out, you know, playing soccer or watching Liverpool or Man United or whatever, I was obsessing over Leonardo da Vinci and Caravaggio and
brilliant,
you know, all this kind of crap. So I used to paint, and then I got into science fiction and fantasy stuff a lot, and I was a big introvert, and then I discovered heavy metal, you know? And then I discovered thrash metal and all the darker stuff, and I was really in my element. And it, you know, I found there were ways, you know, through both those, you know, the actual fantasy art and science fiction stuff, and also the music. There were ways where you could actually, you know, express yourself and all. I see the world as a fairly dark place. I see it as an amazing place, but it's a dark place as well. And okay. You know, those two kind of things were avenues that showed me that there was a whole world of being able to explore and express those kind of, you know, feelings. And not everything is about, you know, milkshakes and pop socks, like, you know, which if you weren't into the heavy metal scene in the 80s, you would have nearly thought the world was about, you know, leg warmers and milkshakes, you know.
So who was the biggest metal band back in the 80s? Who was big? Was it Metallica
Maiden.
Iron Maiden.
Maiden. And then afterwards Metallica, but okay. Maiden were the big boys. Like
Jesus, Michael, I can visualize you driving your car there in your Doc Martens on your little short denim shorts.
Wrong kind of metal, lads. Wrong kind of metal. So Dermot, I came to photography then kind of from painting, because what actually happened was I hadn't time to paint. I had to learn how to use a camera when I was in college, because I studied geology, which was a you know, it was an applied science, and you had to record everything from landscapes and scenery and locations to specimens. Yeah.
Yep.
So then I had to learn how to use a camera, and it was all manual back in those days, and especially if you didn't have the money for anything fancy. So you really had to learn how to use a camera. And at one point, I remember my own band I got into, and you can see, like, we were playing in a thrash metal band, and then I was playing in a death metal band, and you can imagine all this dark imagery coming out of me, because it was like, you know, how could you put it? It was I truly found a creative home in that stuff. I'll put it that way.
I get you.
And when I was taking pictures for the band, I started, and then taking pictures for some friends of mine, I started realizing that the type of stuff I used to draw and paint, and I would be fairly creative with lighting and mood and stuff like that when I was painting, if I was doing fantasy stuff. Like, I did, you know, portraits of people's dogs and illustrations and stuff for to earn a few bob as well, you know.
Yeah,
but super. When I was doing things for me, it was often dark, it was often kind of brooding, very contemplative. And when I at one point I had a bit of an epiphany when I was experimenting with flash, and this was all on film, taking portraits of some friends of mine after I had done some shots of the band. So I was just getting deeper and deeper into realizing that the stuff I used to paint, I could actually do with the camera. And when I was in college, I had no time from that point on, very little time to paint anymore. So photography kind of became the medium, but I didn't really get back into it until about 2006, okay. 2007. So from then on, I just went head first, dived in, because I had to take more band photos, and that meant I bought a camera. Well, that was the excuse anyway.
Very good.
Not sure that even made sense, but
I know it made sense, all right. We all have a good past, like, you know, where our photography comes from. That's very interesting.
Look, I have people who've been friends of mine for years, and even some exes of mine have turned around and said, you know what? The kind of stuff you do, your photography is a bit of a mystery to people because they don't know where it comes from. But anybody who knows you and knows the stuff you're into and knows how you think and how you see things, immediately you can see that in the work. And I thought that was actually from the first time I heard that, it was probably the nicest compliment I ever had.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
that's really cool.
So, Michael, so we know loads about your past. And a few of us around the country know exactly who you are and what you do. But for the listeners, I'd love to tell them more about your ambassador role with Permajet. Now, I got to hear one of your talks at the weekend at Pro Photo Ireland up in Dublin, which is absolutely fantastic. Your sense of humour is great, and you're very witty and creative with your jokes. So I thoroughly enjoyed it. And at first, a few times I didn't get your jokes, and then maybe about 30 seconds later I went, ah, there you go, there was a joke. So I'd laugh about 30 seconds too late.
That's just you, Dad, you're normally slow.
But,
My humour is nothing if not obscure, that's all I'll say.
But can you tell us about Permajet and how they brought you on board and why they brought you on board?
Okay, good question. I was always using Permajet paper, and like when I did my distinctions, I did my AIPF, and then I did my ARPS, and then I went and did my, you know, FIPF. And when I was working for my FRPS, I was obviously back and forward to the UK a bit, and I, you know, made contact with some people over there, like a couple of people, like Rod Whelans, who's based in Scotland, an excellent photographer, himself and Anne Grainer are an excellent photographic team based in Dumfries. Rod was assessing on the day that I had my ARPS, and he approached me, and we had a bit of a chat and stuff like that afterwards. And so, you know, bumping into people like that as I was back and forward, people kind of became familiar with what I was doing. And I'm not sure who else had said it to Rob, and Robin is the MD of Permajet, but they suggested that, you know, it would be probably a good idea to get me or to invite me onto their lecturers team. Because a lot of the paper companies, for people who don't know, they would look at people who were on, say, the lecture circuit in camera clubs. And
yeah,
as a means of, you know, being more visible to the camera club membership. And, you know, because camera club people are probably the population out there who are most into printing. So they're the people who are most likely to, you know, care about high quality paper or good profiling or any of this kind of stuff. So they have lecturers themes, and to be fair, Permajet was the paper I was using already. I was using it anyway. So then I got a call from Robin at one point asking me, would I consider being signing and becoming one of the Permajet lecturers? They've got two programs. They've got Ambassador, and then which is, I guess, there's a certain amount of endorsement involved, and there's a certain amount of commitment involved from the ambassador. But then there's the lecturer, which is more commitment and more endorsement. It's their highest program.
Okay.
So I was very, very flattered, obviously. And you know, that's about 4 years ago. And I'm very happy with them because I've, like I said, it's not like I had to switch paper brands or anything like that. I was already using Permajet and extremely happy with their paper, their profiles, their service. So that was the end of that. That's ideal.
And as a Permajet ambassador, then, like, do you have to sign contracts every year, or
there is a contract because what they do is they support you for your lectures, okay?
Yeah.
So if you're on the lecture circuit, sorry, my phone is buzzing there, so it distracted me a little. If you're on the lecture circuit, you know, you use a lot on paper. So what being a Permajet lecturer means is they give you a certain amount of paper, an allocation of paper to use for your lectures, for entering salons, for whatever you want to do, obviously non-commercial.
Yeah.
And then in return, you let people know you're using Permajet. So, I mean, that was a no-brainer for me because, you know, I love it. So you obviously have to sign contracts because in return, they like a little bit of paperwork back. They like some reports on you know, how you're getting on with stuff, feedback on papers. You might have to test a new surface. There might be a new paper being released and they'd like you to test it, stuff like that. So there is a commitment, but it's nothing crazy.
Yeah, yeah. And you kind of alluded there to the IPF and L panels and affiliate panels and all that. I remember the first time I met you, I was getting my own L panel done back in 2016 up in Mullingar. And at the time, I had no idea about how the circuit worked or how things went. And so I was really excited about the idea of going to Mullingar to do the L panel. But at the same time, I was petrified. I was absolutely bricking it as my panel was coming up. And there was yourself judging, and there was 5 or 6 other judges. And my panel went up in this on these stands, so you'd 5 and 5. Then you normally for your pictures, you take maybe 30 seconds to a minute and a half to judge it, and you're done. But for some strange reason, you took at least about 5 minutes for my panel, and that just made me worse and worse and worse. And I started sweating buckets sitting beside Darren. I think Darren is actually, his internet connection isn't the best, so I think he's left the group, so he can't really comment on it at the moment. But I was absolutely...
No, I'm here.
Oh, you're there. Sorry. There. Okay, so
Darren... Yeah, I was listening to you tell the story about when you actually, you know, were sweating buckets in a seat waiting for... find out how good you were taking photos. It was actually brilliant to sit there next to you, but I wasn't doing it at the time. It was your turn that time. That was brilliant.
It was very good. But I don't think you'd remember the panel, Michael, do you?
Oh, no. I mean, there'd be so many panels over the years unless somebody describes the panel.
I'll describe it for you. It was the most awesome panel you've ever seen in the L.
Oh, yeah, I remember that one.
You remember that one, L?
Yeah, yeah. That was the one. That was my one. But
you were talking about it being nerve-wracking there. I have to say it, right, before we get into anything else. In my opinion, the most difficult distinction level to go, you know, is the licensure. And the reason I say that is because until you go for the licensure, now, it was probably different 10 years ago or whatever when there were less people maybe in some of the clubs, you know, like in Cork Camera Group, there were very few people who had distinctions when I went for mine. So it was completely nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
You didn't know what to expect. There were some, but the licensure is the most difficult level to go for because, you know, unless you know a lot of people who've been through it, you know, and a lot of people out there in clubs, they don't know many people who've gone through it. So it can be nerve-wracking. You don't know what to expect. It's hard to get the best advice. You don't even often know where to get advice, and it's completely nerve-wracking, and you're putting yourself out there and you're putting your work on display to be judged in public at that level for the first time ever for most people, and that is the hardest step to take. I think there are a lot of people out there who never get distinctions for that reason. They never take that first step, you know, and I think that once you do that first step, it kind of takes away the cold sting of going next time and going to the next level, you know, even though photographically the associateship is obviously then more difficult, and fellowship again is, you know, logarithmically, I mean, you're talking exponentially more difficult photographically from a standard point of view. But at the same time, you know, you've already been through a distinction, you know what to expect, and you're kind of already on that ladder. So I would advise anybody out there who's daunt, you know, intimidated by the idea of going and getting their licentiateship, go do it, get on the ladder, because that journey is the best thing that ever happened to me in photography.
Today's episode is brought to you by Hainel Industries. Hainel Industries is one of the leading manufacturers of power products for camcorders and digital cameras. Having celebrated over 50 years in business, Hainel have an excellent reputation in research and development and a well-known history of quality products and excellent design.
Actually, Michael, a question for you there on that. You know, I remember it was a year later when I was going for my L, and similar to Dermot, I was nervous, but I had actually experienced it from sitting there with Dermot, because I went to see what it was about, because I'd never been myself. I wasn't in a camera club or anything like that. And even though when I was going, I created my panel and I sent it. You mentioned it there, and that's what made me think of it, about getting different advice from different people. And I know I sent the panel off probably myself to too many people, and I got too many bits of advice back, and it kind of confused me even more before I decided in the end, okay, this is what I'm going with. What advice would you have for somebody, like you kind of touched on it there, but in general, in about how would they think about their panel for an L, an A, or an F?
Okay, there are a number of ways about going about it. Let's assume somebody has already been working towards trying to get it, okay? And they want to, yeah, they're at the stage where they want to take advice and to have a look at either a selection of images that they're considering to use for a panel or at a prospective panel, okay? Mm-hmm. Contact somebody on the adjudication panel. Contact somebody who assesses distinctions. And even if that means emailing the distinction secretary, Bob Morrison, and asking him to try and put them in touch with somebody, that's probably the best idea, because you'll get all kinds of advice from people who have watched it and, yeah, have sat there and been sat through the distinctions, because obviously, you know, it's done in public.
Yes.
But those people don't have the full picture. They don't know what's, you know, driving some of the interpretations and the decisions that are being made. And mm-hmm. to give you a big example, people often harp on the idea of like, oh, blown highlights. Okay, the judges passed this panel and there are blown highlights, and they didn't pass that panel and there are blown highlights. Okay, so what the hell? So you get people who hear that there was a panel fail, blown highlights were one of the reasons, and then they'll give people advice when they're coming up. And every single panel that has a blown highlight, they'll tell them, oh, no, you can't get it. And, you know, it's the wrong advice in some cases, okay? Mm-hmm. Because to give the example of the blown highlights, if it's something that's not detrimental to the image, and it's not distracting, and it's not a problem from a printing point of view, then it will be okay. But if it's a particular detail, then, for example. Mm. So, you know, the best advice to get is from people who actually sit there and assess the panels. And, you know, don't ask too many people, because you might end up with nobody able to actually judge your panel on the day. But, you know...
Yeah, I get you. Get
in touch with one assessor who will even be able to tell you maybe who's best placed to be able to give you advice on your specific subject matter, your, you know, type of photography, or whatever would be best for you.
Yeah, that's brilliant advice. I think a lot of people actually will benefit from hearing that, because it is quite nerve-wracking, as Dermot would testify to. He wasn't joking. When he was sitting in the seat next to me, he was sweating buckets. Isn't that right, Dermot?
Oh, yeah, man. You could have fit you actually. Yeah, I was terrified. But now, in fairness, now when I came down to get the panel, and you did say, and I'm not giving myself a pat on the back now, you did say the panel was absolutely awesome, because I asked you what the hell took you so long, and you were like, it was so good that you actually took a while to sit back and actually look at the panel properly. You were really, really impressed. It was one of the best L panels all day. So that actually gave me such a big head, I actually barely fitted out the door, you know.
And you were worried about the fact that we took a long time looking at it. Sometimes that can just be because, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean there are things wrong with it, you know.
Yeah,
it can be because there's it merits
right
discussion
with it.
Yeah, it could be because there's lots right with it. It could be because it merits a bit of discussion. It could be for many, many reasons. Often there is something maybe on a panel that might raise a question mark, and we might need to look at it and give it a bit of time. But any time there's time given, it's usually just to be fair to the applicant, rather than being rash. That's all.
Yeah, yeah.
Very good.
Now, John, I know John has a few questions for you there, Michael, about being moody and stuff. He's apparently you're a very moody photographer, so I'll leave John take the reins there now.
Yeah, Michael, I admire your fantasy art. It's something I actually quite like as well. And you know, cool. I have a project in my own head for the last while now. It's very, very dark, and it's very, very personal. And that's something I'd love to bounce off you again on another time. But the one thing that caught my eye with your own stuff was the Fallen Angels gallery.
Yeah.
You know, I was wondering where was your inspiration for that, or what's the story behind the Fallen Angels?
Oh, okay, that's a big one.
It's a big one. The shortened version of it.
Yeah. In a nutshell. I kind of grew up, some of it is to do with background and stuff like that, right? I grew up in a fairly, everything was cool and we were all happy and everything was great and it was a fantastic community. But I grew up in a fairly, I didn't grow up in the most affluent neighborhood in the 80s. Okay, I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
And growing up in a working class family where back then working class often meant not being paid enough to make ends meet.
Yeah.
And my specific area, the area I grew up in Cork, part of the inner city in Cork, the area I grew up in was about 80 or 90% unemployment in the 80s, you know, which was three or four times more than the rest of the city. Now, my dad worked, my mother worked, they worked their fingers to the bone and all this kind of stuff. And I quickly developed this kind of worldview that there's a ceiling, right? And you only get so far. I'm not sure I necessarily agree with that 100% anymore, but I developed this view that there are those who are in charge and there's everyone else.
Okay.
And then, you know, from reading mythology and all this kind of stuff, it became pretty clear to me that, you know, every world mythology, every creation story, they all allude to the same things. You know, there was this advanced race of beings and, you know, who kind of came along and, you know, control humanity and all this stuff. So I had this concept that I developed in my head that I saw that there was a number of levels of manipulation and control happening, that we don't really have free will. It's like we're in that box and there's that ceiling that I was talking about. You can control little things like, you know, will I have Rice Krispies or cornflakes for my breakfast? Or will I go completely nuts and have a banana and yogurt? Do you know what I mean? But you can control things like the major things that affect your life. To a degree you can, but you know, you can't make major decisions that have any major impact at all outside of your brand of cereal. Okay?
Yeah.
Now, that, I think within that you still can advance in this, that and the other. I'm a lot more optimistic than I used to be, but yeah, so I saw that there were these various levels of control. You had the spiritual or you had the mythological, and I saw religion slotting in right there, or, you know, the otherworldly, should we call it. You've a lot of then, you know, these other alternative theories and stuff out there about aliens and all this kind of crack. I'm not saying I subscribe to everything or anything, but I definitely explore it, you know, and then there's the earthly control. So the whole idea of the Fallen Angels series is to take these pinpoint these moments in history that illustrate that for me, because I found from a very young age that if I could make pictures of stuff, it was far easier for me to deal with it and to, you know, express my worldview. And it's very frustrating if you don't find a way to express how you see the world for anybody, you know. And I think that's what drives people to be creative. And you mentioned that project you have coming up is a personal, very personal thing. That's what everybody's projects should be, but a lot of them unfortunately aren't. And I think there's a bit of a hive mind out there in the visual arts, and a lot of people just, oh, I saw that, that's cool, that's a great idea, I'm going to do a version of it, you know. So I think it's important to find something personal. That was that for me. It was the fact that we are basically a lot of lost souls, and the whole Fallen Angels thing is a metaphor I took from the Fallen Angels in Judeo-Christian tradition. But it's a typeset that, you know, reflects any form of, you know, manipulation, control, lack of free will, the whole idea that we're living in a cage or an aquarium, being controlled by rulers at an earthly level and at an otherworldly level. And that there's this hidden hand controlling everything you do, controlling your whole life, you know. Let's not mention the the seal of the Bavarian Illuminati on the back of the US dollar bill or anything. But
Yeah. Pretty good.
Yeah, does that answer your question?
Yeah, that's great. Great. And the one thing that stood out there was you said you had the concept in your head, and like a lot of us do have concepts in our heads, but we don't deliver on them. And you really are delivering on them in your photography. I have to say they're excellent. The The one photo that stood out, and it's actually because I know could have this totally wrong. You had an image of a girl holding, I think it was a skull of a goat. Would that be right?
A deer.
Yeah. Was that Kilcrae Abbey behind? No.
Actually, I'm trying to think. No, which image is that?
I think it may be. And that's.
See, I've used that in a couple of shots, but there was what? Okay, describe the image to me.
The image. She's holding a skull. And yeah, there's a nabby in behind her.
Is she on a table?
She is on. I'm going to see if I can put it up here now when I'm onto you. No, she's in like a, it's like the foreground. She's very close to the foreground. Here it is now. You could go through these images all day long because I think they're great. And the first one is the girl with a violin. No, she's very close. She has a dagger in her right hand and a skull in her left.
She's sitting with a table in front of her.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. A yellow table, yeah.
Yeah,
what's the abbey behind her there? I thought I recognised it.
That is Kilcrae.
That's interesting.
What's a phenomenal location. I've used it a few times.
That's actually where I met Darren for the first time. We had our first shoot together.
True story, yeah.
Yeah.
True love.
I lost you there. I lost you there for a second. I can hear you guys again.
You are better off losing this, Michael. It got a bit weird, to be honest with you, you know.
I was just saying, that's when I bumped into Darren for the first time. It was actually in Kilcrae Abbey. We had a shoot there together for the first time.
So you blame Kilcrae for all your woes?
Yeah, absolutely. just, I have one final question just on your setup now. I know this, you could talk about this for ages, but really, really in a two-liner. What's your lighting setup is great. How many lights would you use a normal shoot like that?
Anywhere between one and, you know, I lost count, you know. It's like the ones of, say, the Giselle shots in the forest where, you know, the death of Giselle where she's laying on the ditch and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I can't remember, but there was like somewhere between 6 and 10 lights in that shot.
Wow, that's great.
Only because they were necessary, right?
Yes, yes.
If I can get away with one light, then I will get away with one light.
Yes, I'm with you,
And people often ask me for advice on lighting and they say, oh, you know, I'm not that good at lighting. I need to learn how to use loads of lights. And you're like, no, you don't. Learn how to use one light. If you can use one light well, then it's easy to introduce a second light. It's easy because you know what you're doing with it. You know how to control it. You know how to see what effect it's having. Yeah. You know how to pre-visualize it. So where possible, even just from a simplicity point of view, I prefer to get away with using one light if I can. In some situations like that, you can't. What I'll often try to do is I won't include anything in a shot unless I can either light it or it's being lit by the sun somehow.
Okay, very interesting. That's a very good point.
Unless it's meant to be backlit or whatever. So you often see images that have these black bushes very close to the camera and they're taking up a big area because the photographer hasn't lit them and it just throws the whole illusion. And we've all done that. I have images back along the way in my early days of my portfolio which have that. But, you know, you learn by experience. And then, you know, once you know to use one light, then suddenly you get the idea that you'll add a second light to light the stuff that it still looks black in a shot the next time.
Yeah.
And before you know it, you're doing a shoot like the Giselle situation where there's like six lights in the forest, just to light the forest and two smoke machines. And there are two or three lights over Giselle in the foreground to give a completely different, you know, the way that's lit. It's like the forest is all fantasy and moody and dark and kind of obscure. And the foreground is kind of lit. Lighting kind of like a romantic painting or something, you know.
That's pretty cool.
Romantic era artwork.
And I suppose for anybody who wants to see your images, what's your website, Michael?
The badly needing to be updated website is
like us all.
www.mosullivanphoto.com.
Okay, very good. And we can see the Fallen Angel gallery. I think you've got two galleries in there for Fallen Angels, isn't that correct?
Yeah, and there's about another two to go in there with the amount of stuff that I've done over the past few years.
Oh, really? Excellent.
Yeah. Okay, like, so
I don't think even I don't think the ballet ones are in there, like Giselle or Sleeping Beauty or any of those are in there.
Awesome.
Okay, cool.
Now, Michael, we're nearly caught for time there, but I just want to get one quick last question, and it has to be 30 seconds or less. Your answer has to be right. So,
okay.
For the next Michael O'Sullivan coming up through the ranks, what's your 30-second word of advice for him?
Don't shoot for the gallery. I think I might be paraphrasing or quoting what's his name, David Bowie there, right? And someone asked him about success in the year you're in, and it's not like I was a massive Bowie fan or anything, obviously, but I respect the guy and his good music, But he, I think he answered the question once saying, don't play to the gallery.
Okay.
So just play for yourself and be true to make sure you're expressing yourself. And in photography, that's vital because, like I said, especially in, you know, you see it on the salon circuit, you see it in clubs, there's a bit of a hive mind and a lot of people are becoming versions of each other. And I think that's very sad. Find your own voice. Find the concept that expresses what you have to say about life and the world, and you'll produce work that's different. And immediately, somebody will pick up on it.
Awesome. That was longer than 30 seconds, but I forgive you.
So, hang on, that was well worth it.
It was worth it.
I've passed Bandon now, so I'm in West Cork, so seconds are longer here, Dermot.
Okay. So, Michael, thank you very much for coming on. You're a great sport, and you're an inspiration to not only me, the two lads, but the whole of Ireland. And so thank you so, so much. And we look forward to crossing paths again very soon.
It's a good thing this is only audio because you'd see me blushing, but thank you very much.
Nice chatting to you, Michael.
No worries. Thanks a million. And I'll talk to you soon. Well done on the podcast, guys. This is brilliant. Fantastic idea. And may it be extremely successful.
Thank you very much, Michael. We'll talk to you soon.
Nice to talk to you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you've enjoyed the Irish Photography Podcast, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and give a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Until next time, guys, keep shooting. If you've enjoyed the Irish Photography Podcast, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and give a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Until next time, guys, keep shooting.